Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, November 24th, 2025 edition of Tucson, Arizona's Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, plentiful sunshine, highs near 65 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's weather, clear skies, lows to 43 degrees Fahrenheit, winds light and variable. Tomorrow's forecast predicts mainly sunny, highs near 70 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, Israel Strikes at Hezbollah in Beirut. This article was written by Fadi Tawel and Karim Shayeb. From the Associated Press, Dateline Haaretz, Tariq, Lebanon. Israel's military said an airstrike on Sunday on Beirut targeted a senior militant from the Lebanese-Iran-aligned Hezbollah group. The strike on the southern suburbs of Lebanon's capital killed at least one person and wounded 21 others, Lebanon's health ministry said. Israel's military said that it targeted Hezbollah's chief of staff without giving further details. Smoke could be seen in the busy Harid Harik neighborhood, with one video circulated on social media showing dozens of people crowded around the area of the strike, which appeared to be on the fourth floor of an apartment building. This is definitely a civilian area and void of any military presence, especially the neighborhood where we stand, Hezbollah parliamentarian Ali Amar told reporters near the scene. Amar did not give details on who the attack targeted. The building stood after the strike, which caused debris to fall on cars parked below. Gunshots could be heard to disperse the crowds as rescue workers and firefighters reached the apartment building. The Lebanese military cordoned off the area. The strike in the south of the capital is the first on Beirut since June and comes days before Pope Leo XIV is scheduled to visit the country. Israeli airstrikes over southern Lebanon have intensified in recent weeks. Israel and the United States have been piling the pressure on Lebanon to disarm the powerful militant group. The Lebanese military issued a plan approved by the government that would disarm Hezbollah. Israel claims Hezbollah is trying to rebuild its military capabilities in southern Lebanon, which is denied by the Lebanon government. Lebanon and United Nations peacekeepers have been critical of ongoing Israel's attacks on the country and accuses them of violating the ceasefire agreement. Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun has said the country is ready to enter negotiations with Israel to stop its airstrikes and to withdraw from five hilltop points it occupies on Lebanese territory. It is unclear if Israel will agree to the offer. Aoun and Prime Minister Nawaz Salam say they are committed to disarming all non-state actors in the country, including Hezbollah. On Tuesday, an Israeli airstrike killed 13 people in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain el-Alawi near the southern city of Sidon in the deadliest attack since a ceasefire went into effect. The military said it targeted a military facility belonging to the Palestinian Hamas militant group. Hamas denied that it has any military facilities in the crowded camp, Shayeb reported from Beirut. The next front page article is titled, Work Rules Put SNAP Benefits in Peril. This article was written by Nick Carmia of Cronkite News. Federal food benefits have been flowing again since the government shutdown ended last week. But for millions of recipients nationwide and tens of thousands of Arizona like Mindy Torres, the restart is only a temporary reprieve. New work requirements could mean that her only reliable source of grocery money will soon disappear. I have what I need for today, but without the monthly food aid, there'll definitely be an issue, said Torres, who left Phoenix 3 years ago when a rent increase became unaffordable. She and her husband bought an RV and settled on a friend's 40-acre property in Cholo. The trailer now sits 28 miles down a dirt road with no running water, an arrangement that fits the government definition of homeless. But in July, Congress removed homelessness as an exemption to work requirements, under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The law took effect November 1st with a 3-month grace period. There are 25 million SNAP residents nationwide, including 775,813 in Arizona as of the state's October's count. The tighter eligibility rules will reduce the rolls by 2.4 million nationwide, according to Congressional Budget Office projections. In Arizona, about 124,000 recipients are at risk of losing benefits, according to an analysis from the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The average monthly payment in Arizona is $185.96 per person, according to the state's Department of Economic Security, which handles SNAP payments. About 40% of recipients nationwide are children. The program costs the federal government about $100 billion a year. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, signed by President Donald Trump, is projected to slash $186 billion over 10 years by shifting administrative costs to states and tightening eligibility. The law requires able-bodied adults ages 18 to 64 to prove they are working at least 80 hours a month, enrolled in school, or participating in a job training program to receive SNAP benefits. Those who can't show proof of eligibility are limited to 3 months of food aid in a 3-year period. Previously, the work requirement ended at age 55. The new law also erases exemptions for veterans, unhoused individuals, and people 18 to 24 who were in foster care when they turned 18. Adults have been exempt if they have a child at home under age 18. Going forward, the cutoff is 14. The law also ends decades of eligibility for refugees, asylum seekers, and immigrants granted legal protection for humanitarian efforts. Those changes will affect victims of sex trafficking and visa holders who worked with the U.S. military in conflict zones. These changes account for about 90,000 people who will lose benefits. For Torres, the requirement to work through age 64 hits home. She turns 55 in July, so she'll remain on food stamps for the next 8 months. After that, she will lose benefits unless she can secure some other exemption. She has a bone disease that precludes her from working, she said. She has been waiting for a disability determination that would keep her eligible. If I just barely bump into something, I'm going to break a bone, she said. I'm in constant pain. She and her husband currently receive $279 a month. They also rely on local charities. You're grateful to get what you get, but it's not like going grocery shopping, she said. You'll get 4 boxes of mac and cheese, but if you don't have money for bread or for milk and butter, how are you supposed to make a box of mac and cheese? The U.S. Department of Agriculture withheld SNAP funds for November until Congress reopened the government on November 12th, after a record-setting 43-day shutdown. 2 days later, the USDA issued a memo to states affirming that the 3-month clock started on schedule on November 1st, despite the shutdown. SNAP recipients contacted since then say they have received their November benefits. That should be true for all Arizona recipients, DES spokesman Brett Bazio said Thursday. Like agencies that handle SNAP in other states, DES says it has sent notices about the new work requirements. Some but not all recipients Cronkite News spoke with were aware of the changes. In Channel, part of the Navajo Nation, resident Alexis K. Inchilini was surprised when told of the new rules. Unemployed, the 37-year-old said she relies on the $284 she receives each month. Without SNAP, she says, she would probably starve. The next article is titled, Immigrant Enrollment Dwindling at U.S. Schools. This article was written by Kate Payne, Bianca Vasquez-Tonez, and Gisela Solomon of the Associated Press. From Miami to San Diego, schools around the U.S. are seeing big drops in enrollment of students from immigrant families. In some cases, parents have been deported or voluntarily returned to their home countries, driven out by President Donald Trump's sweeping immigration crackdown. Others have moved elsewhere inside the U.S. In many school systems, the biggest factor is far fewer families are coming from other countries. As fewer people cross the U.S. border, administrators in small towns and big cities alike are reporting fewer newcomer students than usual. In Miami-Dade County Public Schools, about 2,550 students have entered the district from another country so far this year, down from nearly 14,000 last year and more than 20,000 the year before that. School board member Luisa Santos, who attended district schools herself as a young immigrant, said the trend is a sad reality. "I was one of those arrivals when I was 8 years old," Santos said. "And this country and our public schools, I'll never get tired of saying it, gave me everything." Collectively, the enrollment declines in Miami-Dade erased about $70 million from the district's annual budget. The drops in immigration students add to strains on the enrollment at many traditional public schools, which have seen overall numbers dip due to demographic changes and students opting for alternatives like private schools and homeschooling. Despite the need for English instruction and social support, the newcomers in some districts have helped to buoy enrollment and bring critical per pupil funding in recent years. In northern Alabama, Albertville City School Superintendent Bart Reeves has seen the local economy grow along with its Hispanic population, which for decades has been drawn by the area's poultry processing plants. Reeves District is home to one of Alabama's largest Hispanic student populations, with about 60% identifying as Hispanic. But Reeves said the district's newcomer academy at a local high school hasn't been enrolling any new students. "That's just not happening this year with the closure of the border," said Reeves, who expects the hit to his budget from enrollment declines will cost him about 12 teachers' positions. One Sunday morning in August, Edna, a 63-year-old immigrant from El Salvador, got the call she had been dreading. Her friend, a mother from Guatemala with 7 young children, had been detained in Lake Worth, Florida, on immigration charges while she was out grabbing a treat for her kids' breakfast. The family had prepared for this moment. There were legal documents in place granting temporary custody of the children to Edna, who asked to be identified only by her first name because she fears immigration enforcement. In the weeks that followed, Edna stayed home with two younger kids and got her 5 older siblings on the bus each day to attend Palm Beach County Public Schools, where enrollment has fallen by more than 6,000 students this year. One day in September, all 7 children boarded a plane to Guatemala to be reunited with their mom, leaving behind the only life they had ever known. "My house feels like a garden without flowers," Edna said. "They're all gone." The family is now living in a rural part of Guatemala out of reach of phone service. School there had already started for the year, and the mother, who did not attend school herself as a child, was keeping them home and weighing whether to enroll them next year, Edna said. The decline in the number of immigrants coming to the U.S. was already evident in school registration numbers this summer. Denver Public Schools enrolled 400 new-to-country students this year, compared to the 1,500 during the previous summer. Administrators in the Houston Independent School District shuttered the Las Americas Newcomer School, a program dedicated to children who are new to the U.S., after its enrollment fell to just 21 students from 111 last year. The shift is visible in places like Chelsea, Massachusetts, a city outside Boston that has long been a destination for new immigrants. The 6,000-student Chelsea public school system has attracted Central Americans looking for affordable housing, and more recently the state-housed, newly-arrived Haitians in shelter there. "This year has been different, much more quiet," said Daniel Mayorka, director of Chelsea's Parent Information Center. Over the summer, 152 newcomers signed up for Chelsea public schools, compared to 592 new-to-country students in the previous summer. Since January, 844 students have withdrawn from the district, compared to 805 during the same period last year. Mujica said a greater share of students leaving, roughly a quarter, are returning to their native countries. He attributes that partly to the presence of mass immigration and customs enforcement officers walking the city's streets. "I can feel the fear in the air," he said. In San Diego, Principal Hernandez, or rather Fernando Hernandez, has enrolled dozens of newcomer students from across Latin America over the past couple of years. Many made the treacherous journey through the jungles of the Darien Gap before setting up camp in a park near Perkins K-8 school. About a third of students at the school are homeless. Staff have become experts on supporting kids who are facing adversity. As more newcomers arrived, Hernandez watched as American, or rather Mexican-American students switched up their playground slang to be better understood by their new classmates from Venezuela, Colombia, and Peru. But so far this school year, he hasn't enrolled a single newcomer student. Other families did not return when the new school year began. Hernandez fears the toll of the disruption will extend far beyond students' academic progress. He worries students are missing out on chances to learn how to show empathy, to share, to disagree, to understand each other. This is like a repeat of the pandemic where the kids are isolated, locked up, not socializing, he said. These kids, they have to be in school, he added. Next article from the front page is titled, Cities Across U.S. Fail to Curb Traffic Deaths. This article was written by Chesida Giles of KFF Health News. Dateline Los Angeles. Chris Edwards waited at home with friends for his wife, Erica Tilly Edwards, to go out to dinner, but she never made it back to the house they had purchased only 4 days earlier. Around 9 p.m. on June 29th, a hit-and-run driver killed Tilly as she walked her car after a fundraising performance in Hollywood. I've just got to figure out how to keep living. And the hard part with that is not knowing why, Edward said of his wife's death. Despite local, state, and federal safety campaigns, such as the Global Vision Zero Initiative to eliminate traffic fatalities, such deaths are up 20% in the U.S. from a decade ago, from 32,744 in 2014 to an estimated 39,345 in 2024, according to the data from the Department of Transportation National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Although traffic deaths have declined since peaking at 43,230 in 2021, the number of deaths remains higher than a decade ago. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, the Pew Research Center found Americans' driving habits have worsened across multiple measures, from reckless driving to drunken driving, with road safety advocates call a public health failure. They say technology could dramatically reduce traffic deaths, but proposals often run up against industry resistance. Every day, 20 people go out for a walk and they don't return home, said Adam Snyder, a spokesperson for the Governor's Highway Safety Association, which represents state road safety officers. American roads have become more dangerous than violent crimes in some cities. Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Houston are among the major cities that now report more traffic fatalities than homicides. In 2024, the Los Angeles Police Department reported an estimated 268 homicides and 302 traffic deaths, the second consecutive year that the number of people killed in collisions exceeded the number of homicides victims, according to Crosstown LA, a nonprofit community news outlet. San Francisco reported more than 40 traffic deaths and 35 homicides in 2024. In Houston, approximately 345 people died in crashes and 322 from homicide. Simply put, the United States is in the middle of a road safety emergency. David Harkey, president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, testified during the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing this summer. Out of 29 high-income countries, America ranks at the bottom in road safety, Harkey said. This spike is not a global trend. This is an U.S. outlier. In January 2017, then-Mayor Eric Garcetti joined 13 other LA city leaders in pledging to implement the Vision Zero Action Plan and eliminate traffic deaths in the city by 2025. Instead, deaths have increased. Last year, California State Senator Scott Wiener proposed a bill that would have required new cars sold in the state to include intelligent speed assistance software that could prevent vehicles from exceeding the speed limit by more than 10%, or rather 10 miles per hour. But the bill was watered down following pushback from the auto industry and opposition from some legislators. It was ultimately vetoed by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who said the state mandate would disrupt ongoing federal safety assessments. Meanwhile, the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, an influential automotive lobby, sued the federal government this year over an automatic emergency braking rule adopted during the Biden administration. The lawsuit is pending in federal court while the Department of Transportation completes a review. Even before Donald Trump was sworn in for his second term, the Alliance appealed to the president-elect in a letter to support consumer choice. Under Trump, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy is prioritizing the development of autonomous vehicles by proposing sweeping regulatory changes to test and deploy driverless cars. Federal motor vehicle safety standards were written for vehicles with human drivers and need to be updated for autonomous vehicles, NHTSA Chief Counsel Peter Simsazer said in September in announcing the modernization effort, which includes repealing some safety rules. Removing these requirements will reduce cost and enhance safety. Some Democratic lawmakers, however, have criticized the administration's repeal of safety rules as misguided, since new rules can be implemented without undoing existing safeguards. NHTSA officials did not respond to requests for comment about Democrats' concerns. Advocates worry that without continued adoption of road safety regulations for conventional vehicles, factors such as excessive speed and human error will continue to drive fatalities despite the push for driverless cars. We need to continue to have strong collaboration from the federal, state, and local sectors, public sector, private sector, the everyday public, Snyder of the Governors Highway Safety Association said. We need everyday drivers to get involved. It took nearly a month for police to track down the driver of a Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon allegedly involved in Tilly's death. Authorities have charged Devontae Robbins with vehicular manslaughter, with gross negligence, felony hit-and-run driving, and driving with a suspended license due to a previous DUI. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges and is out on bail. Chris Edwards now tends to the couple's backyard garden by himself. He hopes for justice for his wife, though he said he's unsure if prosecutors will get a conviction. He wants her death to mean something. Safer streets, slower driving, and for pedestrians to be cautious when getting in and out of cars parked on busy streets. I want my wife's death to be a warning to others who got too comfortable and let their guard down, even for a moment, he said. That moment is all it takes. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The first item is titled, Policy Tackles Housing Water. This article was written by Adam Perlman of the Arizona Sonoran News. Pima County supervisors have voted to allow developers to more than double housing density in select neighborhoods, a major policy shift aimed at producing the 116,000 housing units the region needs over the next two decades. The plan, titled Pima Prosperous 2025, confronts a stark reality. the county faces an immediate shortfall of 22,000 units, with another 94,000 units needed to accommodate population growth through 2045. The Board of Supervisors approved the measure 4-1 on October 14th. Chairman Rex Scott and Supervisors Sharon Bronson, Matt Hines, and Andre Cano voted in favor. Supervisor Steve Christie, the lone dissenter, could not be reached for comment. The plan secured backing from both the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association, SAHBA, and the Coalition for Sonoran Desert Protection, a rare consensus that officials say validates a balanced approach to housing and conservation. The urgency stems from a widening gap between people and homes. Between 2017 and 2021, the number of households in the county grew by 9.3%, while housing units increased only 7.3%. That disparity has driven vacancy rates to critical lows, triggering sharp rent increases. According to research by the University of Arizona Rockman Institute, lower-income residents are increasingly cost-burdened, often spending more than a third of their income on rent or mortgages. Suburban communities are feeling the squeeze acutely, with Oro Valley and Marana falling well below healthy vacancy levels. The roots of the crisis trace back to the 2008 recession, when construction plummeted by more than 80%. The COVID-19 pandemic compounded the deficit through supply chain disruptions, labor shortages, and rising interest rates, leaving Pima County lagging behind peer communities in multifamily housing production. In response, Pima County convened an affordable housing task force in 2022 and contracted the Rockman Institute to provide data on housing, climate, and water to guide policy. Rather than sprawling outward, the new plan uses a carrot-not-stick approach in incentivizing denser development with existing communities. Under the new code, projects connecting to renewable Central Arizona Project, CAP water, and county wastewater systems qualify for significant density bonuses. Areas zoned from medium to low residential use can jump from 5 to 12 units per acre, while medium residential zones can increase from 13 to 20 units. Practically, this allows single-family neighborhoods to integrate duplexes and townhomes along traditional ranch-style houses. The plan targets three priority growth areas for this infill development: Casa Adobes, Drexel Heights, and Valencia West. Chris Pierre, the Pima County Development Services Director, points to the redevelopment of the former Foothills Mall, now Uptown, as a prime example. "We would love to see more of that where you see parking lots that are hardly used, maybe aging shopping centers," Pierre said. "The density bonuses come with strings attached. To access them, developers must utilize renewable water sources rather than depleting groundwater. This requirement directly addresses Arizona's long-term water insecurity. The state has been in drought since the mid-1990s, and the Colorado River supply has already faced Tier 1 shortage cuts." Courtney Crossan of the Rockman Institute explained that new projects must calculate baseline water usage and offset it through conservation measures, rainwater harvesting, or payments into infrastructure projects like aquifer storage. "It really depends on the property, the site, the occupancy," Crossan said, regarding specific strategies. "There's a lot of factors that go into finding what's the most appropriate strategy." The plan also upholds the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan. Developers increasing density on sensitive lands must set aside natural areas for mitigation largely within the development site itself. The plan takes effect immediately. Developers submitting rezoning applications will now be processed under the updated policies. "We need the development community to come in for the policy to be applied to them," Poirier said. "But we've at least reduced a lot of barriers. Let the good stuff happen when the market's ready to do it." While the framework provides unprecedented incentives, its success depends on market adoption. Implementation will determine if this policy shift can actually deliver the supply the region needs desperately needs, proponents say. The next article is titled, State Lawsuits Against Trump Mirror Those Against Biden. This article was written by Tufan Nupain of Cronkite News, Dateline, Washington. I go into the office, I sue the federal government, and I go home, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said in early 2013 when he was a state's attorney general. At that point, he had filed 25 lawsuits against President Barack Obama's administration over 4 years, about half of all Republican-led cases that states filed by the end of Obama's 2 terms. At the time, that was an unusually high number of state challenges to presidential authority. But states have increasingly turned to the courts to try to influence national policy, protect states' interests, and block perceived federal overreach. When a Democrat is president, the torrent comes from the Republican state officials. When there's a Republican in office, it's Democrats leading the charge. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mayes has filed or joined 30 such lawsuits since President Donald Trump returned to the White House in January. All but one of the other 22 states with a Democratic state attorney general have filed even more. Arizona has challenged the recent interruption in federal nutrition aid during the government shutdown, immigration enforcement policies, funding cuts for science research, public health and education, Trump's efforts to end automatic citizenship for babies born in the U.S. with no American parent, and regulatory rollbacks intended to accelerate fossil fuel production. This is not what I get up every day wanting to do, Mayes told Cronkite News recently, standing outside the U.S. Supreme Court after arguments on a multi-state challenge to Trump's expansive use of tariff without congressional approval. But if Donald Trump decides to violate the Constitution, violate the statute, or harm the people of Arizona, I'm going to file that lawsuit. Mays boasts that her efforts have already saved Arizona $1.5 billion, though she has won just 2 and lost 2 others. In 15 cases, her side persuaded courts to provide temporary relief. The tally includes temporary wins involving $132 million in education funding and more than $1 billion related to others Trump issued during his first week, freezing just about any federal spending that didn't align with his policy priorities. Progressive State Leaders Committee, an advocacy group that tracks litigation between states and the federal government, counts 63 such cases since Trump returned to office on January 20th. California is part of 47 of those, followed by Oregon with 44. Maryland and Illinois have 43. New York, Minnesota, and Colorado with 42. With just 13, North Carolina is the only state with a Democratic attorney general that has filed fewer cases than Arizona. The District of Columbia, which is ultimately controlled by Congress, but has limited autonomy, is part of 29 cases. Republican attorney general are not part of any of the cases pitting Arizona against the Trump administration. 3 states with Republican attorney generals but Democratic governors, Kentucky, Kansas, and Pennsylvania, have joined some of those cases. During Trump's first term, he faced 155 suits filed by Democratic attorneys general and just 4 by fellow Republicans, according to a database compiled by Paul Nolet, a political scientist in Marquette University. During President Joe Biden's term, Republican attorney generals filed 122 such lawsuits. His fellow Democrats challenged him in court just 8 times. Democratic attorney generals, in vehement disagreement with the Trump administration's stances on immigration, education, environment, financial regulation, have initiated a frenzy of litigation to stop what they see as a dangerous agenda, Nolet wrote in a 2018 paper, in much of the same way that Republican attorney generals took action against the Obama administration. Mays and other Democratic attorney generals cast themselves as champions of taxpayers and citizens. In the tariff case, Arizona, California, and Oregon argued that Trump's move were illegal and raised costs for U.S. consumers and businesses. "We have small businesses in Arizona that are going out of business every day," May said. "I've talked to a furniture manufacturer, a restaurateur, a hotel owner, cattle ranchers, all of whom are struggling because of those tariffs." Through mid-October, the litigation cost the state about $2 million, the Arizona Republic found. Mays asserted that Republican attorney generals are losing billions of dollars by refraining from court fights with the administration. "They're too afraid of Donald Trump because he's a dictator and he will punish them and he will end their political careers," she said outside the Supreme Court. California Attorney General Bob Bonta stressed the importance of defending constituents' rights and budgets against unfair and unlawful federal policies. "Tariffs are taxes. Congress has the power to impose taxes. The president does not," he told reporters at the high court. "He has used tariffs in a sweeping manner to impose 10% to 145% taxes on nearly every one of our trade partners, and workers are suffering. Businesses are suffering. Families across the country are suffering." Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield rejected the suggestion of partisan motives and explained a two-part test he uses when deciding whether to sue the federal government. "Are Oregonians being harmed?" he said. "Is the Constitution or law being violated? If the answer to those two questions is yes, we're filing a lawsuit." The state's track record is mixed under Trump. According to the PSLC tracker, Mays has won temporary pauses in 15 cases. These include challenges to the administration's attempt to dismantle AmeriCorps, cuts to National Institutes of Health funding for medical and public health research, the cancellation of electric vehicles charging infrastructure funds, new immigration rules requiring status verification before access to services, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's demand for data on recipients of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, an anti-hunger program that serves 42 million Americans. Other successful pauses involved a policy that gave the so-called Department of Government Efficiency access to taxpayer data, the executive order seeking to deny birthright citizenship to children of parents in the country illegally or with temporary status, cuts to a federal disaster mitigation program, and an attempt to give immigration authorities access to health data. 8 cases involving Arizona have no decision yet, including Trump's effort to terminate wind energy projects and Solar for All grants to expand access to solar energy for low-income families and to impose restrictions on education grants. In 3 cases, courts have allowed Trump policies to take effect as litigation continues. That includes changes to NIH grant procedures, the delegation of executive power to billionaire Elon Musk when he led the DOGE cost-cutting efforts, and rules governing the Affordable Care Act. In June, the Department of Health and Human Services issued regulations that, among other things, would add verification requirements, impose monthly charges on consumers who qualify for $0 premiums, and shorten the open enrollment period. Democratic attorneys general said that would violate the law and would cause significant harm to states and their residents. Courts have rejected challenges from Arizona to block mass layoffs to probationary federal employees and at the Department of Education, though Arizona and other states successfully blocked that department from rescinding hundreds of millions in grants stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic. Political scientists and legal scholars trace the uptick to multi-state lawsuits against presidents to the 1980s. Both the Republican Attorneys General Association and the Democratic Attorneys General Association frame their roles in openly partisan terms. For over 25 years, Republican attorney generals have been freedom's front line, from successfully challenging Obama and Biden overreach to today helping President Donald J. Trump make America safe free and great again, Raga says on its website. Here's how Daga describes its mission. After years of the Trump administration undermining good government, a Congress that continues to face gridlock, and state houses increasingly capitulating to far-right extremisms, the role that Democratic attorney generals play in protecting democracy and the rule of law is more important than ever. The next article is titled Student-Run EMS Service Handles On-Campus Calls. This article was written by Elise Richmond of the Arizona Sonoran News. In October, the University of Arizona's Emergency Medical Services responding to 112 911 calls, also known as UAEMS. The organization works 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to respond to emergency calls from students, staff, and community members on campus. The agency is run by students. Some people see it from the outside of like, this is just a bunch of college kids, like we've gotten that comment plenty of times, said Becca Duquette, a senior who joined UAEMS in the spring semester of 2024. But in reality, it's been really special to see how much we can truly help people. On October 17th, Duquette helped in an immobilization and minor trauma training for all UAEMS members. She and other members respond to students in emergency situations. They all train each other to improve their EMT skills. It's also a really cool teaching opportunity for our veteran members, just being able to help each other out and kind of help them grow in that process, Duquette added. Jake Albert, a public information officer for UAEMS, helped assist with the training. He has experienced firsthand the impact the agency has on students. Herbert remembers one call where he and his team responded to a student who had attempted suicide. Being there and giving that person a hug and just staying with that person until we can get them to the hospital, Herbert recalled. That was a call that's probably had the biggest impact on me. Members of the UAEMS are EMT certified. The students rotate through shifts at the EMS station located on the south side of campus. On shift, they go through a series of operations that include debriefing with the crew from the shift above, doing a bag check in their emergency vehicles, and talking with one another while they wait for a 911 call. A large part of UAEMS services is responding to emergency calls, but they also educate the community. The organization offers public courses such as CPR certification, Narcan training, and how to stop bleeding. Cassie Medina is a lead public information officer. Part of her job is to help instruct these courses. So having people who are educated and knowledgeable really increases the public safety of our university and overall has a really positive impact on people and their lives, she said. Medina believes educational trainings are essential to supporting the community. I think that's really my favorite part to hear when they really did use the skills that they learned and they were able to act, and most of the time, like truly save someone's life, Medina added. Now from the Nation of the World section, several important news articles. The first item is titled, Ukraine's Allies Push Back on U.S. Plan. This article came from the Associated Press, Dateline Kiev, Ukraine. Ukraine's Western allies rallied around the war-torn country Saturday as they pushed to revise a U.S. peace plan seen as favoring Moscow despite its all-out invasion of its neighbor. President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed Ukrainians will always defend their home. A Ukrainian delegation bolstered by European representatives prepared for direct talks with Washington and Switzerland on Sunday. Zelensky confirmed the meeting on Saturday. The 28-point blueprint drawn up by the U.S. to end a nearly four-year war sparked alarm in Kiev and European capitals. American senators also panned the proposal at an international security conference Saturday. The plan oversees Ukraine handing over territory to Russia, something Kiev repeatedly ruled out. while reducing the size of its army and blocking its coveted path to NATO membership. It contains many of Moscow's long-standing demands while offering limited security guarantees to Kiev. Speaking to reporters Saturday outside the White House, President Donald Trump said the U.S. proposal was not his final offer. The White House didn't respond to a request for clarification. U.S. senators critical of Trump's approach to ending the war said Saturday they spoke with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who told them the peace plan Trump pushed Kiev to accept is a wish list of the Russians and not the actual U.S. plan. It rewards aggression. It's pure and simple. There's no ethical, legal, moral, political justification for Russia claiming eastern Ukraine, independent Maine Senator Angus King said earlier in the day during a panel discussion at the Halifax International Security Forum in Canada, calling the plan one of the most serious geopolitical mistakes in my lifetime. He compared it to the Munich Pact with Adolf Hitler in 1938, a failed act of appeasement. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, said in a statement, "If administration officials are more concerned with appeasing Putin than securing real peace, then the president ought to find new advisors." Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, said McConnell's criticism didn't go far enough. "Putin is a murderer, a rapist, and an assassin," Tillis said. "We should not do anything that makes him feel like he has a win here. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, called the plan an outrage. On Saturday, leaders of the European Union, Canada, and Japan issued a joint statement welcoming U.S. peace efforts, but pushed back against key tenets of the plan. "We are ready to engage in order to ensure that a future peace is sustainable. We are clear on the principle that borders must not be changed by force. We are also concerned that the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, which would leave Ukraine vulnerable to future attack," it said. It added that any decisions regarding NATO and the EU would require a consent of member states. The leaders of France, Germany, and the UK met on the sidelines of a Group of 20 summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss ways to support Kiev, according to a person with knowledge of the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz told reporters at the summit that wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries affected, and insisted Kiev needs robust guarantees. French President Emmanuel Macron said the U.S. plan requires broader consultation because it stipulates many things involving Europeans, such as Russia's frozen assets and Ukraine's accession to the European Union. Merz and Macron said envoys from France, Germany, and the UK and the UE will join Ukrainian negotiators as they meet a U.S. delegation in Geneva on Sunday to discuss Washington's proposal. Zelensky confirmed the meeting Saturday after Trump set a deadline for Kiev to respond to the plan by next Thursday. European leaders long warned against rushing a peace deal, seeing their own future at stake in Ukraine's fight to beat back Russia, and insist on being consulted in peace efforts. European leaders long accused Russia of stalling diplomatic efforts in the hope of overwhelming Ukraine's much smaller forces on the battlefield. Kiev accepted U.S. ceasefire proposals this year, while Moscow held out for more favorable terms. Time and again, Russia pretends to be serious about peace, but their actions never live up to their words. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer told reporters days after a Russian strike in western Ukraine killed more than 24 civilians. An end to the war can only be achieved with the unconditional consent of Ukraine, Merz said during G20 summit briefing, adding that he told Trump in a phone call Friday that Europe needs to be a part of a peace process and Russia failed to keep its promises to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said a key principle of Kiev's European allies was nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. Zelensky, in a video address, noted real peace is always based on security and justice. On Saturday, Ukraine commemorated a famine Soviet leader Joseph Stalin imposed in the early 1930s that led to millions of deaths. We all know how and why millions of our people died, starved to death, and millions were never born. And we are once again defending ourselves against Russia, which has not changed and is once again bringing death. Zelensky said in a post on Telegram marking Holodomor Memorial Day. We defended, defend, and will always defend Ukraine, because only here is our home, he added. And in our home, Russia will definitely not be the master. The next item is titled, UN Climate Deal Lacks Fossil Fuel Plan. This article was written by Seth Borenstein, Melina Walling, and Anton L. Delgado of the Associated Press, Dateline Belém, Brazil. United Nations climate talks in Brazil reached a subdued agreement Saturday that pledged more funding for countries to adapt to the wrath of extreme weather. But the catch-all agreement doesn't include explicit details to phase out fossil fuels or strengthen countries' inadequate emissions-cutting plans, which dozens of nations demanded. The Brazilian hosts of the conference said they'd eventually come up with a roadmap to get away from fossil fuels working with hardline Colombia, but it won't have the same force as something approved at the conference called COP30. Colombia responded angrily to the deal after it was approved, citing the absence of wording on fossil fuels. The deal, which was approved after negotiators blew past a Friday deadline, was crafted after hours of late night and early morning meetings. After the deal was approved, COP30 President André Correia de Lago said the tough discussions started in Belém will continue under Brazil's leadership until the next annual conference, even if they are not reflected in this text we just approved. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the deal shows that nations can still come together to confront the defining challenges no country can solve alone. But he added, we cannot pretend that COP30 has delivered everything that is needed. The gap between where we are and what science demands remains dangerously wide. Many gave the deal lukewarm praise as the best that could be achieved in trying times, while others complained about the package or the process that led to its approval. Given the circumstances of geopolitics today, we're actually quite pleased without the bounds of the package that came out, said Palau Ambassador Ilana Said, who chaired the Coalition of Small Island Nations. The alternative is that we don't get a decision, and it would have been a worse alternative. This deal isn't perfect and is far from what science requires, said former Ireland President Mary Robinson, a fierce climate advocate for the ex-leaders group, the Elders. But at a time when multilateralism is being tested, it is significant that countries continue to move forward together. Absent from the talks was the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. This year there has been a lot of attention on one country stepping back, UN Climate Chief Simon Steele said, referring to the United States' withdrawal from the landmark 2015 Paris Agreement. But amid the gale-force political headwinds, 194 countries stood firm in solidarity, rock-solid in support of climate cooperation. Some countries said they got enough out of the deal. COP30 has not delivered everything Africa asked for, but it has moved the needle, said Jiwo Abdoulaye, Sierra Leone's environment minister. What really matters, he said, is how quickly these words turn into real projects that protect lives and livelihood. UK Energy Minister Ed Miliband said the agreement was an important step forward, but that he would have preferred it to be more ambitious, he added. These are difficult, strenuous, tiring, frustrating negotiations. The deal was approved minutes into a plenary meeting open Saturday to all nations that were present. After the main package was approved, to applause by many delegates, angry nations took the floor to complain about other parts of the package and about being ignored as DuLago moved quickly toward approval. The objections were so strong that DuLago temporarily halted the session to try to calm things down. Colombia's Daniela Duran-Gonzalez blasted the conference president for ignoring her, saying, "The COP of truth cannot support an outcome that ignores science." An area that usually gets less attention became a big point of contention. The approved deal established 59 indicators for the world to judge how nations are adapting to climate change before the Belém conference. Experts crafted 100 precisely worded indicators, but negotiators changed the wording to cut the total. The European Union, several Latin American countries, and Canada said they had severe problems with it, calling it unclear and unworkable. They complained that they tried to object but were ignored. DuLago apologized. A handful of major issues dominated the talk. Those included coming up with a roadmap to wean the world from fossil fuels, telling countries that their national plans to curb emissions were inadequate, tripling financial aid for developing nations to adapt to extreme weather, and reducing climate restrictions on trade. COP30 gave us some baby steps in the right directions, but considering the scale of the climate crisis, it has failed to rise to the occasion, said Mohamed Adao, director of PowerShift Africa. Critics complained there was not much to the deal. Strip away the outcome text and you'll see it plainly. The emperor has no clothes, said former Philippe negotiator Jasper Inventor Dow at Greenpeace International. Panama negotiator Juan Carlos Monterrey Gomez railed against the deal. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the November 24th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.